Side 5, Domes of Fire, The Tomilly, Book 1, by David Eddings, continuing on page 162. Colton's attitude toward Aileen was strange. Once he had been persuaded not to press his attentions on her, he had become rather fiercely protective. "If anybody insulted you, I'll go back and teach him better manners."
"No, my lord," the girl replied disconsolately. "It was nothing like that. It's just that they're all trapped in that awful place. They hate each other, but they'll have to spend the rest of their lives together, and they'll go on cutting little pieces out of each other until they're all dead."
"Someone once told me that there's a certain kind of justice at work in situations like that," Sparhawk observed, not looking at his daughter. "All right, then. We all had the chance to talk with the members of our host's family individually. Did anyone pick up anything useful?"
"The serfs are right on the verge of open rebellion, my lord," Khalad said. "I sort of drifted around the stable and other outbuildings and talked with them. The Baroness's father was a kindly master, I guess, and the serfs loved him. After he died, though, Kotick started to show his real nature. He's a brutal sort of man, and he's very fond of using the knout."
"What's a knout?" Talon asked.
"It's a sort of scourge," his half-brother replied bleakly.
"A whip?"
"It goes a little further than that. Serfs are lazy, Sparhawk. There's no question about that. And they've perfected the art of either pretending to be stupid or feigning illness or injury. It's always been a sort of game, I guess. The masters knew what the serfs were up to, and the serfs knew that they weren't really fooling anybody. Actually, I think they all enjoyed it. Then, a few years ago, the masters suddenly stopped playing. Instead of trying to coax the serfs to work, the gentry began to resort to the knout. They threw 1,000 years of tradition out the window and turned vicious overnight. The serfs can't understand it. Kotick's not the only noble who's been mistreating his serfs. They say it's been happening all over Western Astel. Serfs tend to exaggerate things, but they all seem to be convinced that their masters have set out on a course of deliberate brutality designed to eradicate traditional rights and to reduce the serfs to absolute slavery. A serf can't be sold, but a slave can. The one they call Saber has been making quite an issue of that. If you tell a man that somebody's planning to sell his wife and children, you're going to get him just a little bit excited."
"That doesn't match up too well with what Baron Kotick was telling me," Patriarch Emban put in. "The Baron drank more than was really good for him last night, and he let a number of things slip that he otherwise might not have. It's his position that Saber's primary goal is to drive the Tummels out of Astel. To be honest with you, Sparhawk, I was a bit skeptical about what the thief and Iso said about this Saber fellow, but he certainly has the attention of the nobles. He's been making an issue of racial and religious differences between Alenes and Tummels. Kotick kept referring to the Tummels as godless yellow dogs."
"We have gods, your grace," Oscania protested mildly. "If you give me a few moments, I might even be able to remember some of their names." "Our friend Saber's been busy," Tinian said. "He's saying one thing to the nobles and another to the serfs." "I think it's called talking out of both sides of your face at once," Ulaf noted.
"I believe the Empire might want to give the discovery of Saber's identity a certain priority," Oscania mused. "It's embarrassingly predictable, but we brutal oppressors and godless yellow dogs always want to identify ringleaders and troublemakers."
"So that you can catch them and hang them?" Talon accused.
"Not necessarily, young man. When a natural talent rises to the surface, one shouldn't waste it. I'm sure we can find a use for this fellow's gifts." "But he hates your empire, Your Excellency," Elana pointed out. "That's no real drawback, Your Majesty," Oscania smiled. "The fact that a man hates the empire doesn't automatically make him a criminal. Anyone with any common sense hates the empire. There are days when even the emperor himself hates it. The presence of revolutionaries is a fair indication that something's seriously wrong in a given province. The revolutionaries made it his business to pinpoint the problems, so it's easier in the long run to just let him go ahead and fix things. I've known quite a few revolutionaries who made very good provincial governors.
That's an interesting line of thought, Your Excellency, Ilana said. But how do you persuade people who hate you to go to work for you?
You trick them, Your Majesty. You just ask them if they think they can do any better. They inevitably think they can, so you just tell them to have a go at it. It usually takes them a few months to realize that they've been had. Being a provincial governor is the worst job in the world. Everybody hates you.
Where does the Syachin fit in? Bevier asked.
I gather he's the rallying point, Stregan replied. Sort of the way Drichtnoth is in Lamorkand.
A figurehead? Tinian suggested.
Most probably. You wouldn't really expect a ninth-century hero to understand contemporary political reality.
He's sort of an enigma, though, Uloth pointed out. The nobility believes he was one sort of man, and the serfs believe he's another. Saber must have two different sets of speeches. Just exactly who was Ayachin, anyway?
Kotick told me that he was a minor nobleman who was very devoted to the Estellian Church, and then supplied. In the 9th century, there was a church-inspired invasion from Eosia. Your thief in Issos was right about that part, at least. The Astels believe that our Holy Mother in Kyrellos is heretical. Ayachin's supposed to have rallied the nobles, and finally won a great victory in the Astel marshes.
The serfs have a different story, Halad told them. They believe that Ayachin was a serf disguised as a nobleman, and that his real goal was the emancipation of his class. They say that the victory in the marshes was the work of the serfs, not the nobility. Later, when the nobles found out who Ayachin really was, they had him murdered.
He makes a perfect figurehead then, Ilana said. He was so ambiguous that he seems to offer something to everyone.
Emban was frowning.
The mistreatment of the serfs doesn't make any sense. Serfs aren't very industrious, but there are so many of them that all you have to do is pile on more people until you get the job done. If you maltreat them, all you really do is encourage them to turn on you. Even an idiot knows that. Sparhawk, is there some spell that might have induced the nobility to follow a course that's ultimately suicidal?
None that I know of, Sparhawk replied. He looked around at the other knights, and they all shook their heads. Princess Danae nodded very slightly, however, indicating that there might very well be some way to do what Emban suggested. I wouldn't discount the possibility, though, Your Grace, he added. Just because none of us knows the spell doesn't mean that there isn't one. If someone wanted turmoil here in Astel, there's probably nothing that would have suited his purposes better than a serf uprising. And if all the nobles started knouting their serfs at about the same time, it would have been a perfect way to set one off.
And this Saber fellow seems to be responsible, Emban said. He's stirring the nobles against the godless yellow dogs. Sorry, Oscania. And at the same time, he's agitating the serfs against their masters. Was anyone able to pick up anything about him?
Elrond was in his cups last night, too, Stregan said. He told Sparhawk and me that Saber creeps around at night wearing a mask and making speeches.
You're not serious, Bevier asked incredulously.
Pathetic, isn't it? We're obviously dealing with a juvenile mind here. Elrond's quite overwhelmed by the melodrama of it all.
He would be, Bevier sighed.
It does sort of sound like the fabrication of a third-rate literary fellow, doesn't it?
Stregan smiled.
That's Elrond, all right, Tinian said.
You're flattering him, Uloth grunted. He trapped me in a corner last night and recited some of his verse to me. Third rate is a gross overstatement of his talent.
Sparhawk was troubled. Afriel had told him that someone at Kotick's house would say something important, but aside from the revelation of some fairly unsavory personality defects, no one had directly told him anything of earth-shaking note. Then he recalled that Afriel had not, in fact, promised that whatever was so important would be said to him. Quite possibly, it had been revealed to one of the others.
He brooded about it. The simplest way to resolve the question would be to ask his daughter, but to do that would once more expose him to some offensive comments about his limited understanding. So he decided that he'd much prefer to work it out for himself. Their map indicated that the journey to the capital at Darsus would take them 10 days. It actually did not, of course.
"How do you deal with people who happen to see us when we're moving this way?"
he asked Danny as they proceeded along at that accelerated pace later that day. He looked at his blank-faced, uncomprehending friends.
"I've got a sort of an idea of how you convince the people who are traveling with us that we're just plodding along. But what about strangers?"
"We don't move this way when there are strangers around, Sparhawk," she replied. "But they wouldn't see us anyway. We're going too fast."
"You're freezing time, then, the same way Gnome did in Pelosia?"
"No, I'm actually doing just the opposite. Gnome froze time and made you plod along through an endless second. What I'm doing is..." She looked speculatively at her father. "I'll explain it some other time," she decided. "We're moving in little spurts, a few miles at a time. Then we amble along for a while, and then we spurt ahead again. Making it all fit together is really very challenging. It gives me something to occupy my mind during these long, boring journeys."
"Did that important thing you mentioned get said?" he asked her.
"Yes."
"What was it?"
He decided that a small bruise on his dignity wouldn't really hurt all that much. "I don't know. I know that it was important, and that somebody was going to say it, but I don't know the details."
"Then you're not omniscient."
"I never said that I was."
"Could it have come in bits and pieces? A word or two to Emban, a couple to Stragan and me, and quite a bit more to Khalad? And then we sort of had to put them all together to get the whole message?"
She thought about it. "That's brilliant, Father," she exclaimed.
"Thank you."
Their speculations earlier had borne some fruit after all. Then he pushed it a bit further.
"Is someone here in Astell changing the attitudes of the people?"
"Yes, but that goes on all the time."
"So when the nobility began to mistreat their serfs, it wasn't their own idea?"
"Of course not. Deliberate, calculated cruelty is very hard to maintain. You have to concentrate on it, and the Astells are too lazy for that. It was externally imposed."
"Could a Styric magician have done it?"
"One by one, yes. Asteric could have selected one nobleman and turned him into a monster." She thought a moment. "Maybe two," she amended. "Three at the most. There are too many variables for a human to keep track of when you get past that."
"Then it's a god or gods that made them all start mistreating their serfs here a few years back?"
"I thought I just said that."
He ignored that and went on. "And the whole purpose was to make the serfs resentful and ready to listen to someone inciting them to revolution?"
"Your logic is blinding me, Sparhawk."
"You can be a very offensive little girl when you set your mind to it. Did you know that?"
"But you love me anyway, don't you? Get to the point, Sparhawk. It's almost time for me to wake the others."
"And the sudden resentment directed at the Tamils came from the same source, didn't it?"
"And probably at about the same time," she agreed. "It's easier to do it all at once. Going back into someone's mind over and over is so tedious." A sudden thought came to him.
"How many things can you think about at the same time?" he asked her.
"I've never counted. Several thousand, I'd imagine. Of course, there aren't really any limits. I guess if I really wanted to, I could think about everything all at once. I'll try it sometime and let you know."
"That's really the difference between us, isn't it? You can think about more things at the same time than I can."
"Well, that's one of the differences."
"What's another?"
"You're a boy and I'm a girl."
"That's fairly obvious, and not very profound."
"You're wrong, Sparhawk. It's much, much more profound than you could ever imagine." After they crossed the river on Toon, they entered a heavily forested region where rocky crags jutted up above the treetops here and there. The weather continued blustery and threatening, though it did not rain. Kring's Paloi were very uncomfortable in the forest, and they rode huddled close to the church knights, their eyes a bit wild.
"We might want to remember that," Ulof noted late that afternoon,
jerking his chin in the direction of a pair of savage-looking, shaved-headed warriors following so closely behind Barrett but their mounts were almost treading on his horse's hind hooves. "What was that?" Carlton asked him. "Don't take the Paloi into the woods." Uloth paused and leaned back in his saddle. "I knew a girl in Hyde one summer who felt more or less the same way," he reminisced. "She was absolutely terrified of the woods. The young men of the town sort of gave up on her, even though she was a great beauty. Hyde's a crowded little town, and there are always aunts and grandmothers and younger brothers underfoot in the houses. The young men have found that the woods offer the kind of privacy young people need from time to time. But this girl wouldn't go near the woods. Then I made an amazing discovery. The girl was afraid of the woods, but she was absolutely fearless where hay barns were concerned. I tested the theory personally any number of times, and she never once showed the slightest bit of timidity about barns, or goat sheds either, for that matter."
"I really don't get the connection," Carlton said. "We were talking about the fact that the Paloi are afraid of the woods. If somebody attacks us here in this forest, we're not going to have time to stop and build a barn for them, are we?"
"No, I suppose you're right about that."
"All right, what is the connection, then?"
"I don't think there is one, Carlton."
"Why did you tell the story, then?"
"Well, it's an awfully good story, don't you think?" Uloth sounded a bit injured. Talon came galloping forward.
"I think you'd better come back to the carriage, Sir Knights."
He laughed, trying without much success to control his mirth. "What's the trouble?" Sparhawk asked him.
"We've got company. Well, not company exactly, but there's somebody watching us."
Sparhawk and the others wheeled their mounts and rode back along the column to the carriage.
"You've got to see this, Sparhawk," Stragan said, trying to stifle his laughter. "Don't be too obvious when you look, but there's a man on horseback on top of that crag off to the left side of the road."
Sparhawk leaned forward as if speaking to his wife, and raised his eyes to look at the rocky crag jutting up from the forest floor. The rider was about 40 yards away, and he was outlined by the sunset behind him. He was making no attempt to conceal himself. He sat astride a black horse, and his clothing was all of the same hue. His inky cape streamed out from his shoulders in the stiff wind, and his broad-brimmed hat was crammed tightly down on his head. His face was covered with a bag-like black mask, with two large, slightly off-center eye-holes in it.
"Isn't that the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen in your life?" Stragan laughed. "Very impressive," Uloth murmured. "At least he's impressed."
"I wish I had a crossbow," Carlton said.
"Barrett, do you think you could nick him a little with your longbow?"
"It might be a little chancy in this wind, Carlton," the young knight replied. "It might deflect my arrow and kill him instead."
"How long's he going to sit there?" Mirtai asked.
"Until he's sure that everybody in the column has seen him, I expect," Stragan said. "He went to a lot of trouble to deck himself out like that. What do you think, Sparhawk? Is that the fellow Elrond told us about?"
"The mask certainly fits," Sparhawk agreed. "I wasn't expecting all the rest, though."
"What's this?" Amban asked.
"Unless Sparhawk and I are mistaken, Your Grace, we are privileged to be in the presence of a living legend. I think that's Saber, the masked whatever you call it, making his evening rounds."
"What on earth is he doing?" Oscania sounded baffled.
"I imagine that he's out wronging rights, depressing the oppressed, and generally making an ass of himself, Your Excellency. He looks as if he's having a lot of fun, though."
The masked rider reared his horse dramatically, and his black cape swirled around him. Then he plunged down the far side of the crag and was gone.
"Wait,"
Stragan urged, before the others could move.
"For what?"
Carlton asked.
"Listen."
From beyond the crag came the brassy note of a horn that trailed off into a distinctly unmusical squawk.
"He had to have a horn," Stragan explained. "No performance like that would ever be complete without a horn." He laughed delightedly. "Maybe if he practices, he'll even learn to carry a tune with it."
Darsus was an ancient city situated on the east bank of the river Astel. The bridge that approached it was a massive arch that had probably been in place for at least 1,000 years, and most of the city's buildings showed a similar antiquity. The cobbled streets were narrow and twisting, following quite probably paths along which cows had gone to water eons in the past. Although its antiquity seemed strange, there was still something profoundly familiar about Darsus. It was an almost prototypical Aline town, and Sparhawk felt as if his very bones were responding to its peculiar architecture. Ambassador Oscania led them through the narrow street and cluttered bazaars to an imposing square at the center of the city. He pointed out a fairy tale structure with a broad gate and soaring towers bedecked with brightly colored pennons. "The Royal Palace," he told Sparhawk. "I'll speak with Ambassador Fontan, our local man, and he'll take us to see King Alberon. I'll only be a moment." Sparhawk nodded. "Carlton," he called to his friend, "let's sort of form up the troops. A bit of ceremony might be in order here." When Oscania emerged from the Tamil embassy, which was conveniently located in a building adjoining the palace, he was accompanied by an ancient-appearing Tamil, whose head was totally hairless, and whose face was as wrinkled as the skin of a very old apple. "Prince Sparhawk," Oscania said quite formally, "I have the honor to present His Excellency Ambassador Fontan, His Imperial Majesty's representative here in the Kingdom of Astel." Sparhawk and Fontan exchanged polite bows. "Have I Your Highness permission to present His Excellency to Her Majesty the Queen?" Oscania asked.
"Tedious, isn't it, Sparhawk?" Fontan asked in a voice as dry as dust. "Oscania's a good boy. He was my most promising pupil. But his fondness for ritual and formula overcomes him at times."
"I'll borrow a sword and immolate myself at once, Fontan," Oscania bantered.
"I've seen you fumbling with a sword, Oscania," Fontan replied. "If you're suicidally inclined, go molest a cobra instead. If you try to do it with a sword, you'll take all week."
"I gather that I'm watching a reunion of sorts," Sparhawk smiled.
"I always like to lower Oscania's opinion of himself, Sparhawk," Fontan replied. "He's brilliant, of course, but sometimes he lacks humility. Now, why don't you introduce me to your wife? She's much prettier than you are, and the Imperial Messenger from Mathurian rode 3 horses to death, bringing me the Emperor's instructions to be excruciatingly nice to her. We'll chat for a few moments, and then I'll take you to meet my dear, incompetent friend, the King. I'm sure he'll swoon at the unspeakable honor your Queen's visit does him."
Ilana was delighted to meet the Ambassador. Sparhawk knew that to be true, because she said so herself. She invited the ancient Tamil, the real ruler of Astel, to join her in the carriage, and the entire party moved rather inexorably on to the palace gates. The captain of the palace guard was nervous. When 200 professional killers descend on one with implacable pace, one is almost always nervous. Ambassador Fontan put him at ease, and 3 messengers were dispatched to advise the king of their arrival. Sparhawk decided not to ask the captain why he sent 3. The poor man was having a bad enough day already. The party was escorted into the palace courtyard, where they dismounted and turned their horses over to the stable hands.
"Behave yourself," Sparhawk muttered to Farron, as a slack-mouthed groom took the reins.
There seemed to be a great deal of activity going on in the palace. Windows kept popping open, and excited people stuck their heads out to gape.
"It's the steel clothing, I think,"
Fontan observed to the Queen.
"The appearance of Your Majesty's escort on the doorstep may very well set a new fashion. A whole generation of tailors may have to learn blacksmithing." He shrugged. "Oh, well," he added, "it's a useful trade. They can always shoe horses when business is slow."
He looked at his pupil, who had returned to the carriage.
"You should have sent word on ahead, Oscania. Now we'll have to wait while everyone inside scurries around to make ready for us."
After several moments, a group of liveried trumpeters filed onto a balcony over the palace door and blew a shattering fanfare. The courtyard was enclosed by stone buildings, and the echoes from the trumpets were almost sufficient to unhorse the knights. Fontaine climbed down from the carriage and offered Elana his arm with a graceful courtliness. "Your Excellency is exquisitely courteous," she murmured.
"Evidence of a misspent youth, my dear." "Your teacher's manner seems quite familiar, Ambassador Oscania," Stregan smiled.
"My imitation of him is only a poor shadow of my master's perfection, milord." Oscania looked fondly at his wrinkled tutor. "We all try to imitate him. His successes in the field of diplomacy are legendary. Don't be deceived, Stregan. When he's being urbane and ironically humorous, he's completely disarming you and gathering more information about you than you could ever imagine. Fontaine can read a man's entire character in the twitch of one of his eyebrows."
"I expect I'll be quite a challenge to him," Stregan said, "since I don't have any character to speak of."
"You deceive yourself, milord. You're not nearly as unprincipled as you'd like us to believe." A stout factotum in splendid scarlet livery escorted them into the palace and along a broad, well-lighted corridor. Ambassador Oscania walked just behind their escort, identifying the members of their party as they went. The broad doors at the end of the corridor swung wide, and their liveried guide preceded them into a vast, ornate throne room filled with excited courtiers. The factotum thunderously pounded on the floor with the butt of the staff that was his badge of office.
"My lords and ladies," he boomed, "I have the honor to present Her Divine Majesty, Queen Elana, of the Kingdom of Alenia."
"Divine?" Calton murmured to Sparhawk. "It grows more evident as you get to know her better." The liveried herald continued his introductions, laboriously embellishing their individual titles as he presented them. Oscania had quite obviously done his homework very thoroughly, and the herald dusted off seldom-used ornaments of rank in his introductory remarks. Calton's nearly forgotten baronetcy emerged. Bevier was exposed as a viscount, Tinian as a duke, and Ulloth as an earl. Most surprising of all, perhaps, was the revelation that Barrett, plain, earnest Barrett, had been concealing the title of Marquis in his luggage. Stregan was introduced as a baron.
"My father's title,"
the blonde thief explained to them in an apologetic whisper.
"Since I killed him and my brothers, I suppose it technically belongs to me. Spoils of war, you understand."
"My goodness," Baroness Melodir murmured, her blue eyes alight. "I seem to be standing in the middle of a whole constellation of stars." She seemed positively breathless.
"I wish she wouldn't do that," Stregan complained.
"What's the problem?" Calton asked him.
"She makes it seem as if the light in her eyes is the sun streaming in through the hole in the back of her head. I know she's far more clever than that. I hate dishonest people." "You?" "Let it lie, Calton."
The throne room of King Alboran of Astel was filled with an awed silence as the eminence of the visitors was revealed. King Alboran himself, an ineffectual-looking fellow whose royal robes looked a size or so too large for him, seemed to shrink with each new title. Alboran, it appeared, had weak eyes, and his myopic gaze gave him the fearful, timid look of a rabbit or some other such small, helpless animal that all other creatures look upon as a food source. The splendor of his throne room seemed to shrink him all the more. The wide expanses of crimson carpets and drapes, the massive gilt and crystal chandeliers and marble columns, providing an heroic setting that he could never hope to fill. Sparhawk's queen, regal and lovely, approached the throne on Ambassador Fontaine's arm, with her steel-plated entourage drawn up around her. King Alboran seemed a bit uncertain about the customary ceremonies. As the reigning monarch of Astel, he was entitled to remain seated upon his throne. But the fact that his entire court genuflected as Elana passed intimidated him, and he rose to his feet and even stepped down from the dais to greet her. "Now our life has seen its crown," Elana proclaimed in her most formal and oratorical style, "for we have, as God most surely must have decreed since time's beginning, come at last into the presence of our dear brother of Astel,
whom we have longed to meet since our earliest girlhood.
Is she speaking for all of us? Talon whispered to Barret. I didn't really have a girlhood, you know.
She's using the royal plural, Barret explained. The queen's more than one person. She's speaking for the entire kingdom.
We are honored more than we can say, Your Majesty, Alberon faltered.
Aelana quickly assessed her host's limitations and smoothly adopted a less formal tone. She abandoned ceremony and unleashed her charm on the poor fellow. At the end of 5 minutes, they were chatting together as if they had known each other all their lives. At the end of 10, he'd have given her his crown had she asked for it. After the obligatory exchanges, Sparhawk and the other members of Aelana's entourage moved away from the throne to engage in that silly but necessary pastime known as circulating. They talked about the weather, mostly. The weather is a politically correct topic. Emban and Archimandrite Monsel, the head of the Church of Astel, exchanged theological platitudes without touching on those doctrinal differences that divided their two churches. Monsel wore an elaborate mitre and intricately embroidered vestments. He also wore a full black beard that reached to his waist. Sparhawk had discovered early in life that a scowl was his best defense in such situations, and he customarily intimidated whole rooms full of people who might otherwise inflict conversational inanities upon him.
Are you in some kind of distress, Prince Sparhawk?
It was Ambassador Fontan who dared to speak, quietly.
Your face has a decidedly dyspeptic cast to it.
It's entirely tactical, Your Excellency, Sparhawk replied. When a military man doesn't want to be pestered, he digs a ditch and lines the bottom and sides with sharpened stakes. A scowl serves the same purpose in social situations.
You look bristly enough, my boy. Let's take a turn around the battlements and enjoy the view, the fresh air, and the privacy. There are things you should know, and this may be my only chance to get you alone. King Alberon's court is full of inconsequential people who would all die for the chance to be able to maneuver conversation around to the point where they can assert that they know you personally. You have quite a reputation, you know.
Largely exaggerated, Your Excellency. You're too modest, my boy. Shall we go?
They left the throne room unobtrusively and climbed several flights of stairs until they came out on the windswept battlements. Fontan looked down at the city spread below.
Quaint, wouldn't you say?
Elene cities are always quaint, Your Excellency, Sparhawk replied. Elene architects haven't had a new idea in the last 5 millennia.
Mathirion will open your eyes, Sparhawk. All right, then. Astel's right on the verge of flying apart. So's the rest of the world. But Astel's carrying it to extremes. I'm doing what I can to hold things together, but Alberon's so pliable that almost anyone can influence him. He'll literally sign anything anybody puts in front of him. You've heard about Ayachin, of course. And his running dog, Saber?
Sparhawk nodded.
I've got every Imperial agent in Astel out trying to identify Saber, but we haven't had much luck so far. He's out there blithely dismantling a system the Empire spent centuries creating. We don't really know very much about him.
He's an adolescent, Your Excellency, Sparhawk said. No matter what his age, he's profoundly juvenile.
He briefly described the incident in the forest.
That's helpful, Fontan said. None of my people have ever been able to infiltrate one of those famous meetings, so we had no idea what sort of fellow we were dealing with. He's got the nobility completely in his grasp. I stopped Alberon just in time a few weeks ago, when he was on the verge of signing a proclamation which would have criminalized a serf if he ran away. That would have brought the kingdom down around our ears, I'm afraid. That's always been the serf's final answer to an intolerable situation. If he can run away and stay away for a year and a day, he's free. If you take that away from the serfs, they'll revolt. And a serf rebellion is too hideous a notion to even contemplate.
It's quite deliberate, Your Excellency, Sparhawk advised him. Saber's agitating the serfs as well. He wants a serf rebellion here in Astel. He's been using his influence over the nobility to
persuade them to commit the exact blunders that will outrage the serfs all the more.
What's the man thinking of? Fontaine burst out. He'll drown Astell in blood.
Sparhawk made an intuitive leap at that point. I don't think he really cares about Astell, Your Excellency. Saber's no more than a tool for someone who has his eyes on a much bigger goal.
Oh? What's that?
I'm guessing, Your Excellency. But I think there's somebody out there who wants the whole world, and he'd sacrifice Astell and every living person in it to get what he wants.
Chapter 12. It's hard to put your finger on it, Prince Sparhawk, Baroness Melodir said that evening, after the extended royal family had retired to their oversized apartment for the night. At the Queen's insistence, Melodir, Mirtai, and Aileen, her maid, had been provided with rooms in the apartment. Helana needed women around her for a number of reasons, some practical, some political, and some very obscure. The ladies had removed their formal gowns, and, except for Mirtai, they wore soft pastel dressing gowns. Melodir was brushing Mirtai's wealth of blue-black hair, and the doe-eyed Aileen was performing the same service for Helana.
I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, the honey-blonde baroness continued. It's a sort of generalized sadness. They all sigh a great deal.
I noticed that myself, Sparhawk, Aileen told her husband. Alberyn hardly smiles at all, and I can make anybody smile.
Your presence alone is enough to make us all smile, my queen, Talon told her. Talon was the queen's page, and he was also a member of the extended family. The young thief was elegant tonight, dressed in a plum-colored velvet doublet and knee breeches in the same shade and fabric. Knee breeches were just coming into fashion, and Aileen had tried her very best to get Sparhawk into a pair of them. He had categorically refused, and his wife had been obliged to settle for coercing her page into the ridiculous-looking garments.
The plan is to make you a knight, Talon, Melodir told the boy pointedly, not a courtier.
Stragan says it's always a good idea to have something to fall back on, Baroness. He shrugged, his voice cracking and warbling somewhere between soprano and baritone.
He would,
the Baroness sniffed. Melodir affected a strong disapproval of Stragan, but Sparhawk was not so sure about how she really felt. Talon and Princess Danae sat on the floor rolling a ball back and forth between them. Myrrh was participating in the game enthusiastically.
They all seem to secretly believe that the world's going to come to an end week after next, the Baroness went on, slowly drawing her brush through Mirtai's hair. They're all bright and brittle on the surface, but once you get beneath that, there's the blackest melancholy, and they all drink like fish. I couldn't prove this, but I really think they all believe they're going to die very soon.
She lifted Mirtai's hair speculatively.
I think I'll braid a gold chain into it, dear,
she told the giantess.
No, Melodir, Mirtai said firmly. I'm not entitled to wear gold yet.
Every woman's entitled to wear gold, Mirtai, Melodir laughed, provided that she can charm it out of some man.
Not among my people,
Mirtai disagreed.
Gold is for adults. Children don't wear it.
You're hardly a child, Mirtai.
I am until I go through a certain ceremony.
Silver, Melodir, or steel. You can't make jewelry out of steel.
You can if you polish it enough.
Melodir sighed.
Fetch me the silver chains, Talon, she said.
For the present, that was Talon's function. He fetched things. He didn't like it very much, but he did it, largely because Mirtai was bigger than he was. There was a polite knock at the door, and Talon veered over to answer it. Ambassador Oscania entered. He bowed to Aileen.
I've spoken with Fontaine, Your Majesty, he reported. He's sending to the garrison at Cannae for 2 Aton legions to escort us to Methyrium. I'm sure we'll all feel more secure with them around us.
What's a legion, Your Excellency?
Talon asked, crossing the room to the jewelry cabinet.
1,000 warriors, Oscania replied.
He smiled at Aileen.
With 2,000 Atons at your disposal, Your Majesty could conquer Edom. Would you like to establish a toehold on the Dirisian continent? It won't really be all that inconvenient. We Tamils will administer it for you, for the usual fee, of course, and we'll send you glowing reports at the end of each year. The reports will be a tissue of lies, but we'll send them anyway. Along with the profits? She actually sounded interested. Oh, no, Your Majesty, he laughed. For some reason, not one single kingdom in the whole empire ever shows a profit, except Tamil itself, of course. Why would I want a kingdom that doesn't pay? Prestige, Your Majesty, and vanity. You'd have another title and another crown. I don't really need another crown, Your Excellency. I've only got one head. Why don't we just let the King of Edom keep his unprofitable kingdom? Probably a wise decision, Your Majesty, he agreed. Edom's a tedious sort of place. They grow wheat there, and wheat farmers are a stodgy group of people, all obsessively interested in the weather.
How long is it likely to be until those legions arrive? Sparhawk asked him.
A week or so. They'll come on foot, so they'll make better time than they would on horseback.
Isn't it the other way around, Your Excellency?
Meladir asked him.
I thought horses moved much faster than men on foot.
Mirtai laughed.
Did I say something funny?
Meladir asked.
When I was 14, a man down in Daconia insulted me, the giantess told her. He was drunk. When he sobered up the next morning, he realized what he'd done and fled on horseback. It was about dawn. I caught up with him just before noon. His horse had died from exhaustion. I always felt sort of sorry for the horse. A trained warrior can run all day. A horse can't. A horse has to stop when he wants to eat, so he's not used to running for more than a few hours at a time. We eat while we're running, so we just keep on going.
What did you do to the fellow who insulted you? Talon asked her.
Do you really want to know?
No, Mirtai, he replied. Now that you mention it, probably not. And so they had a week on their hands. Baroness Meladir devoted her time to breaking hearts. The young noblemen of King Alberin's court flocked around her. She flirted outrageously, made all sorts of promises, none of which she kept, and occasionally allowed herself to be kissed in dark corners by persistent suitors. She had a great deal of fun, and gathered a great deal of information. A young man pursuing a pretty girl will often share secrets with her, secrets that he should probably keep to himself. To the surprise of Sparhawk and his fellow knights, Sir Barrett devastated the young ladies of the court quite nearly as much as the Baroness did the young men.
It's absolutely uncanny, Carlton was saying one evening. He doesn't really do anything at all.
He doesn't talk to them. He doesn't smile at them.
He doesn't do any of the things he's supposed to do. I don't know what it is, but every time he walks through a room, every young woman in the place starts to come all unraveled.
He is a very handsome young man, Carlton, Ilana pointed out.
Barrett? He doesn't even shave regularly yet.
What's that got to do with it? He's tall, he's a knight, he has broad shoulders and good manners. He's also got the deepest blue eyes I've ever seen, and the longest eyelashes.
But he's only a boy.
Not anymore. You haven't really looked at him lately. Besides, the young ladies who sigh and cry into their pillows over him are quite young themselves.
What's really so irritating is the fact that he doesn't even know what effect he has on all those poor girls, Tinian observed. They're doing everything but tearing their clothes off to get his attention, and he hasn't got the faintest notion of what's going on.
That's part of his charm, Sir Knight, Ilana smiled. If it weren't for that innocence of his, they wouldn't find him nearly so attractive. Sir Bevier here has much the same quality. The difference, though, is that Sir Bevier knows that he's an extraordinarily handsome young man. He chooses not to do anything about it because of his religious convictions. Barrett doesn't even know.
Maybe one of us should take him aside and tell him, Ulof suggested.
Never mind, Mirtai told him. He's fine just the way he is. Leave him alone.
Mirtai's right, Ilana said. Don't tamper with him, gentlemen. We'd like to keep him innocent for just a while longer. A hint of mischief touched her lips. Sir Bevier, on the other hand, is quite another matter. It's time for us to find him a wife.
He'll make some girl an excellent husband.
Bevier smiled faintly.
I'm already married, Your Majesty, to the Church. Betrothed, perhaps, Bevier, but not yet married. Don't start buying ecclesiastical garb just yet, Sir Knight. I haven't entirely given up on you. Wouldn't it be easier to start closer to home, Your Majesty? He suggested. If you feel the urge to marry someone off, Sir Calton is readily at hand.
Calton? She asked incredulously.
Don't be absurd, Devier. I wouldn't do that to any woman.
Your Majesty! Calton protested.
I love you dearly, Calton, she smiled at the blonde Pandion. But you're just not husband material. I couldn't give you away. In good conscience, I couldn't even order anyone to marry you. Tinian is remotely possible, but God intended you and Olaf to be bachelors.
Me? Olaf said mildly.
Yes, she said, you.
The door opened, and Stragan and Talon entered. They were both dressed in the plain clothing they usually wore when making one of their sorties into the streets.
Any luck? Sparhawk asked them.
We found him,
Stragan replied, handing his cloak to Aileen.
He's not really my sort. He's a pickpocket by profession, and pickpockets don't really make good leaders. There's something fundamentally lacking in their character.
Stragan,
Talon protested.
You're not really a pickpocket, my young friend, Stragan told him. That's only an interim occupation while you're waiting to grow up. Anyway, the local chief's named Kondrak. He could see that we all have a mutual interest in stable governments. I'll give him that. Looting houses when there's turmoil in the streets is a fast way to make a lot of money. But over the long run, a good thief can accumulate more in times of domestic tranquility. Of course, Kondrak can't make any kind of overall decision on his own. He'll have to consult with his counterparts in other cities in the Empire.
That shouldn't take more than a year or so, Sparhawk noted dryly.
Hardly, Stragan disagreed. Thieves move much more rapidly than honest men. Kondrak's going to send out word of what we're trying to accomplish. He'll put it in the best possible light, so there's a very good chance that the thieves of all the kingdoms in the Empire will cooperate.
How will we know their decision? Tinian asked him.
I'll make courtesy calls each time we come to a fair-sized city.
Stragan shrugged.
Sooner or later I'll get an official reply. It shouldn't take that long. We'll certainly have a final decision by the time we reach Matherion.
He looked speculatively at Aelana.
Your Majesty's learned a great deal about the subterranean government in the past few years, he noted. Do you suppose we could put that information on the level of a state secret? We're perfectly willing to cooperate, and even assist on occasion. But we'd be much happier if the other monarchs of the world didn't know too much about the way we operate. Some crusader might decide to smash the secret government, and that would inconvenience us a bit.
"What's it worth to you, Milord Stragan?" she teased him.
His eyes grew very serious.
"It's a decision you'll have to make for yourself, Aelana," he told her, cutting across rank and customary courtesies. "I've tried to assist you whenever I could because I'm genuinely fond of you. If you make a little conversational slip, though, and other monarchs find out things they shouldn't know, I won't be able to do that anymore."
"You'd abandon me, Milord Stragan?"
Never, my queen. But my colleagues would have me killed, and I wouldn't really be of much use to you in that condition, now would I?
Archimandrite Monsel was a large, impressive man, with piercing black eyes and an imposing black beard. It was a forceful beard, an assertive beard, a beard impossible to overlook, and the Archimandrite used it like a battering ram. It preceded him by a yard wherever he went. It bristled when he was irritated, which was often, and in damp weather it knotted up into snarls like a half a mile of cheap fishing line. The beard waggled when Monsel talked, emphasizing points all on its own. Patriarch Emban was absolutely fascinated by the Archimandrite's beard.
"It's like talking to an animated hedge," he observed to Sparhawk, as the two of them walked through the corridors of the palace toward a private audience with the Estellian ecclesiast.
Are there any topics I should avoid, Your Grace? Sparhawk asked. I'm not familiar with the Church of Astel, and I don't want to start any theological debates.
Our disagreements with the Astels are in the field of church government, Sparhawk. Our purely theological differences are very minor. We have a secular clergy, but their church is monastically organized. Our priests are just priests. Theirs are also monks. I'll grant you that it's a fine distinction, but it's a distinction nonetheless. They also have many, many more priests and monks than we do. Probably about a tenth of the population.
That many?
Oh, yes. Every noble mansion in Astel has its own private chapel and its own priest, and the priest assists in making decisions.
Where do they find so many men willing to enter the priesthood?
From the ranks of the serfs. Being a clergyman has its drawbacks, but it's better than being a serf.
I suppose the church would be preferable.
Much. Mansell will respect you, because you're a member of a religious order. Oh, incidentally, since you're the interim preceptor of the Pandion Knights, you're technically a patriarch. Don't be surprised if he addresses you as Your Grace.
They were admitted into Mansell's chambers by a long-bearded monk. Sparhawk had noticed that all Astellian clergymen wore beards. The room was small and paneled in dark wood. The carpet was a deep maroon, and the heavy drapes at the windows were black. There were books and scrolls and dog-eared sheets of parchment everywhere.
Ah, Emban, Mansell said. What have you been up to?
Mischief, Mansell. I've been out proselytizing among the heathens.
Really?
Where did you find any here? I thought most heathens lived in the basilica in Kyrellos. Sit down, gentlemen. I'll send for some wine and we can debate theology.
You've met Sparhawk?
Emban asked as they all took chairs before an open window where the breeze billowed the black drapes.
Briefly, Mansell replied. How are you today, Your Highness?
Well, and Your Grace?
Curious more than anything. Why are we engaging in private consultations?
We're all clergymen, Your Grace, Emban pointed out. Sparhawk wears a cassock made of steel most of the time, but he is of the clergy. We've come to discuss something that probably concerns you as much as it does us. I think I know you well enough to know that you've got a practical side that's not going to get sidetracked by the fact that you think we genuflect wrong.
What's this? Sparhawk asked.
We kneel on our right knee,
Emban shrugged. These poor benighted heathens kneel on the left.
Shocking, Sparhawk murmured. Do you think we should come here in force and compel them to do it right?
You see,
Emban said to the Archimandrite, that's exactly what I was talking about. You should fall to your knees and thank God that you're not saddled with church knights, Mansell. I think most of them secretly worship spheric gods.
Only the younger gods, Your Grace, Sparhawk said mildly. We've had our differences with the elder gods.
He says it so casually, Mansell shuddered. If you think we've exhausted the conversational potential of genuflectory variation, Emban, why don't you get to the point?
This is in strictest confidence, Your Grace, but our mission here to Tamale is not entirely what it seems. It was Queen Elana's idea, of course. She's not the sort to go anywhere just because somebody tells her to. But all of this elaborate falderal was just a subterfuge to hide our real purpose, which was to put Sparhawk on the Dirigian continent. The world's coming apart at the seams, so we've decided to let him fix it.
I thought that was God's job.
God's busy just now, and he's got complete confidence in Sparhawk. All sorts of gods feel that way about him, I understand.
Mansell's eyes widened, and his beard bristled.
Relax, Mansell, Emban told him. We of the church are not required to believe in other gods. All we have to do is make a few allowances for their speculative existence.
Oh, that's different. If this is speculation, I suppose it's all right.
There's one thing that isn't speculation, Your Grace, Sparhawk said. You've got trouble here in Astel. You've noticed. Your Highness is very perceptive. You may not have been advised, since the Tamils are trying to keep it on a low key, but very similar things are afoot in many other Dirigian kingdoms, and we are beginning to encounter the same sort of problem in Eosia.
I think the Tamils sometimes keep secrets just for the fun of it, Mansell grunted.
I have a friend who says the same thing about our Eosian church,
Sparhawk said cautiously. They had not yet fully explored the Archimandrite's political opinions. A wrong word or two here would not only preclude any possibility of obtaining his help, but might even compromise their mission.
Knowledge is power,
M'Ban said rather sententiously.
And only a fool shares power if he doesn't have to. Let me be blunt, Monsel. What's your opinion of the Tamils?
I don't like them. Monsel's response was to the point. They're heathens, they're members of an alien race, and you can't tell what they're thinking. Sparhawk's heart sank. I have to admit, though, that when they absorbed Estelle into their empire, it was the best thing that ever happened to us. Whether we like them or not is beside the point. Their passion for order and stability has averted war time and time again in my own lifetime. There have been other empires in ages past, and their time of ascendancy was a time of unmitigated horror and suffering. I think we'll candidly have to admit that the Tamils are history's finest imperialists. They don't interfere with local customs or religions, they don't disrupt the social structure, and they function through the established governments. Their taxes, however much we complain about them, are really minimal. They build good roads and encourage trade. Aside from that, they generally leave us alone. About all they really insist upon is that we don't go to war with each other. I can live with that, although some of my predecessors felt dreadfully abused because the Tamils wouldn't let them convert their neighbors by the sword. Sparhawk breathed a little easier. But I'm straying from the point here, Monsel said. You were suggesting a worldwide conspiracy of some kind, I think.
Were we suggesting that, Sparhawk?
M'Ban asked.
I suppose we were, Your Grace.
Do you have anything concrete upon which to base this theory, Sir Sparhawk? Monsel asked.
Logic is about all, Your Grace.
I listen to logic, as long as she doesn't contradict my beliefs.
If a series of events happens in one place, and it's identical to a series of events taking place in another, we're justified in considering the possibility of a common source, wouldn't you say?
On an interim basis, perhaps?
It's about all we have to work with at the moment, Your Grace. The same sort of thing could happen at the same time in two different places, and still be a coincidence. But when you get up to 5 or 10 different occurrences, coincidence sort of goes out the window. This current upheaval involving Ayachin and the one they call Saber here in Estelle is almost exactly duplicated in the kingdom of Lamorkand in Eosia, and Ambassador Oscania assures us that the same sort of thing's erupting in other Daresian kingdoms as well. It's always the same. First there are rumors that some towering hero of antiquity has somehow returned. Then some firebrand emerges to keep things stirred up. Here in Estelle, you've got the wild stories about Ayachin. In Lamorkand, they talk about Drichtnoth. Here you have a man named Saber, and in Lamorkand, they've got one named Garrick. I'm fairly sure we'll find the same sort of thing in Edom, Daconia, Arjuna, and Sineska. Oscania tells us that their national heroes are putting in an appearance as well.
Sparhawk rather carefully avoided mentioning Krager. He was still not entirely certain where Monsel's sympathies lay. You build a good case, Sparhawk, Monsel conceded. But couldn't this master plot be directed at the Tamils? They aren't widely loved, you know.
I think Your Grace is overlooking Lamorkand, M'Ban said. There aren't any Tamils there. I'm guessing, but I'd say that the master plot, if that's what we want to call it, is directed at the church in Eosia, as opposed to the empire here.
Organized anarchy, perhaps?
I believe that's a contradiction in terms, Your Grace, Sparhawk pointed out. I'm not sure that we're far enough along to deal with causes yet, though. Right now, we're trying to sort through effects. If we're correct in assuming that these plots are all coming from the same person, then what we're seeing is someone who's got a basic plan with common elements which he modifies to fit each particular culture. What we really want to do is to identify this Saber fellow.
So that you can have him killed? Monsel's tone was accusing.
No, Your Grace, that wouldn't be practical. If we kill him, he'll be replaced by someone else, somebody we don't know. I want to know who he is and what he is and everything I can possibly find out about him. I want to know how he thinks, what drives him, and what his personal motivations are. If I know all of that,
I can neutralize him without killing him. To be completely honest with you, I don't really care about Saber. I want the one who's behind him.
Monsell seemed shaken. This is a dreadful man, Ambam, he said in a hushed tone. Implacable is the word, I think.
If we can believe Oscania, and I think we can, someone's using the arcane arts in this business, Sparhawk told them. That's why the church knights were created originally. It's our business to deal with magic. Our lean religion can't cope with it because there's no place in our faith for it. We had to go outside the faith, to the Styrix, to learn how to counteract magic. It opened some doors we might have preferred had been left closed, but that's the price we had to pay. Somebody, or something, on the other side's using magic of a very high order. I'm here to stop him, to kill him if need be. Once he's gone, the Aetons can deal with Saber. I know an Aeton, and if her people are at all like her, I know we can count on them to be thorough.
You trouble me, Sparhawk, Monsell admitted. Your devotion to your duty is almost inhuman, and your resolve goes even beyond that. You shame me, Sparhawk. He sighed and sat tugging at his beard, his eyes lost in thought. Finally, he straightened. All right, Emban, can we suspend the rules? I didn't quite follow that. I wasn't going to tell you this, the Archimandrite said. First of all, because it'll probably raise your doctrinal hackles, but more importantly, because I didn't really want to share it with you. This implacable Sparhawk of yours has convinced me otherwise. If I don't tell you what I know, he'll dismantle Astell and everyone in it to get the information. Won't you, Sparhawk?
I'd really hate that, Your Grace.
But you'd do it anyway, wouldn't you?
If I had to.
Monsell shuddered. You're both churchmen, so I'm going to invoke the rule of clerical confidentiality. You haven't changed the requirements of that in Kyrellos yet, have you, Emban? Not unless Sarathi did it since I've been gone. At any rate, you have our word that neither of us will reveal anything you tell us. Except to another clergyman, Monsell amended. I'll go that far. All right, Emban agreed. Monsell leaned back in his chair, stroking his beard. The Tummels have no real conception of how powerful the church is in the Aline kingdoms here in Western Derisia, he began. In the first place, their religion's hardly more than a set of ceremonies. Tummels don't even think about religion, so they can't understand the depth of the faith in the hearts of the devout. And the serfs of Astell are quite likely the most devout people on earth. They take all of their problems to their priests, and not only their own problems, but their neighbors as well. The serfs are everywhere, and they see everything, and they tell their priests. I think it was called tale-bearing when I was in the seminary, Emban noted.
We had a worse name for it during our novitiate, Sparhawk added. All sorts of unpleasant accidents used to happen on the training field because of it.
Nobody likes a snitch, Monsell agreed. But like it or not, the Astellian clergy knows everything that happens in the kingdom. Literally everything. We are sworn to keep these secrets, of course, but we feel that our primary responsibility is to the spiritual health of our flock. Since a large proportion of our priests were originally serfs, they simply don't have the theological training to deal with complex spiritual problems. We've devised a way to provide them with the advice they need. The serf priests do not reveal the names of those who have come to them, but they do take serious matters to their superiors, and their superiors bring those matters to me. I have no real difficulty with that, Emban said. As long as the names are kept secret, the confidentiality hasn't been violated. We'll get on well together, Emban. Monsell smiled briefly. The serfs look upon Saber as a liberator.
So we gathered, Sparhawk told him. There seems to be a certain lack of consistency in his speeches, though. He tells the nobles that Ayachin wants to throw off the Tamil yoke, and then he tells the serfs that Ayachin's real goal is the abolition of serfdom. Moreover, he's persuaded the nobles to become very brutal in their dealings with the serfs. That's not only disgusting, it's irrational. The nobles should be trying to enlist the serfs, not alienate them. Viewed realistically, Saber's no more than an agitator, and he's not even particularly subtle. He's a political adolescent.
That's going a little far, Sparhawk, Emban protested. How do you account for his success, then? An idiot like that could never persuade the Astells to accept his word.
They're not accepting his word. They're accepting Iachines.
Have you taken leave of your senses, Sparhawk?
No, Your Grace. I mentioned before that someone on the other side's been using magic. This is what I was talking about. The people here have actually been seeing Iachine himself. That's absurd. Monzel seemed profoundly disturbed. Sparhawk sighed. For the sake of Your Grace's theological comfort, let's call it some kind of hallucination. A mass illusion created by a clever charlatan, or some accomplice dressed in archaic clothing, who appears suddenly in some spectacular fashion. Whatever its source, if what's happening here is anything like what's happening in Lamorcand, your people are absolutely convinced that Iachine's returned from the grave. Saber probably makes a speech, a rambling collection of disconnected platitudes, and then this hallucination appears in a flash of light and a clap of thunder and confirms all his pronouncements. That's a guess, of course, but it's probably not too far off the mark. It's an elaborate hoax, then?
If that's what you want to believe, Your Grace.
But you don't believe it's a hoax, do you, Sparhawk? I've been trained not to actively disbelieve things, Your Grace. Whether the apparition of Iachine is real or some trick is beside the point. It's what the people believe that's important, and I'm sure they believe that Iachine's returned and that Saber speaks for him. That's what makes Saber so dangerous. With the apparition to support him, he can make people believe anything. That's why I have to find out everything about him that I can. I have to be able to know what he's going to do so that I can counter him. I'm going to behave as if I believe what you've just told me, Sparhawk, Monsel said in a troubled voice. I really think you need some spiritual help, though. His face grew grave. We know who Saber is, he said finally. We've known for over a year now. At first we believed, as you do, that he was no more than a disturbed fanatic with a taste for melodrama. We expected the Tamils to deal with him, so we didn't think we had to do anything ourselves. I've had some second thoughts on that score of late, though. On the condition that neither of you will reveal anything I say except to another clergyman, I'll tell you who he is. Do I have your word on that condition?
You have, Your Grace, Amban swore.
And you, Sparhawk?
Of course.
Very well, then. Saber's the younger brother-in-law of a minor nobleman who has an estate a few leagues to the east of Issos.
It all fell into place in Sparhawk's mind with a loud clank.
The nobleman is a Baron Kotick, a silly, ineffectual ass, Monsel told them. And you were quite right, Sparhawk. Saber's a melodramatic adolescent named Elron.
Chapter 13.
That's impossible, Sparhawk exclaimed. Monsel was taken aback by his sudden vehemence. We have more than ample evidence, Sir Sparhawk. The serf who reported the fact has known him since childhood. You've met Elron, I gather.
We took shelter from a storm in Baron Kotick's house, Amban explained. Elron could be Saber, you know, Sparhawk. He's certainly got the right kind of mentality. Why are you so certain he's not the one?
He couldn't have caught up with us, Sparhawk said lamely.
Monsel looked baffled.
We saw Saber in the woods on our way here, Amban told him. It was the sort of thing you'd expect. A masked man in black on a black horse outlined against the sky. Silliest thing I ever saw. We weren't really moving all that fast, Sparhawk. Elron could have caught up with us quite easily.
Sparhawk could not tell him that they had, in fact, been moving far too rapidly for anyone to have caught them. Not with Afriel tampering with time and distance the way she had been. He choked back his objections.
It just surprised me, that's all, he lied. Stragan and I spoke with Elron the night we were there. I can't believe he'd be out stirring up the serfs. He had nothing but contempt for them.
A pose, perhaps? Monsel suggested. Something to conceal his real feelings?
I don't think he's capable of that, Your Grace. He was too ingenuous for that kind of subtlety.
Don't be too quick to make judgments, Sparhawk, Amban told him. If there's magic involved, it wouldn't make any difference what kind of man Saber is, would it? Isn't there some way he could be rather tightly controlled?
Several, actually, Sparhawk admitted.
I'm a little surprised you didn't consider that yourself. You're the expert on magic. Elrond's personal beliefs are probably beside the point. When he's speaking as Saber, it's the man behind him, our real adversary, who's talking.
I should have thought of that. Sparhawk was angry with himself for having overlooked the obvious, and the equally obvious explanation for Elrond's ability to overtake them. Another god could certainly compress time and distance the same way Afriel could.
Just how widespread is this contempt for the serfs, Your Grace? He asked Monsel.
Unfortunately, it's almost universal, Prince Barhawk, Monsel sighed. The serfs are uneducated and superstitious, but they're not nearly as stupid as the nobility would like to believe. The reports I've received tell me that Saber spends almost as much time denouncing the serfs as he does the Tamils when he's speaking to the nobility. Lazy is about the kindest thing he says about them. He's managed to half-persuade the gentry that the serfs are in league with the Tamils in some vast, dark plot, with its ultimate goal being the emancipation of the serfs and the redistribution of the land. The nobles are responding predictably. First, they were goaded into hating the Tamils, and then they were led to believe that the serfs are in league with the Tamils, and that their estates and positions are threatened by that alliance. They don't dare confront the Tamils directly because of the Etons, so they're venting their hostility on their own serfs. There have been incidents of unprovoked savagery upon a class of people who will march en masse into heaven at final judgment. The church is doing what she can, but there's only so far we can go in restraining the gentry.
You need some church knights, Your Grace, Sparhawk said in a bleak tone of voice. We are very good in the field of justice. If you take a nobleman's knout away from him and apply it to his own back a few times, he tends to see the light very quickly.
I wish that were possible here in Astell, Sir Sparhawk, Monsel replied sadly. Unfortunately, it was the same chill, and that same annoying flicker at the edge of the eye. Monsel broke off and looked around quickly, trying to see what could not really be seen. What? He started. It's a visitation, Your Grace, Amban told him, his voice tense. Don't dislocate your neck trying to catch a glimpse of it. He raised his voice slightly. Awfully good to see you again, old boy, he said. We were beginning to think you'd forgotten about us. Was there something you wanted in particular, or were you just yearning for our company? We're flattered, of course, but we're a little busy at the moment. Why don't you run along and play now? We can chat some other time.
The chill quite suddenly turned hot, and the flicker darkened.
Are you insane, Amban? Sparhawk choked.
I don't think so, the fat little patriarch said. Your flickering friend, or friends, are irritating me, that's all.
The shadow vanished, and the air around them returned to normal.
What was that all about? Monsel demanded. The patriarch of Usera just insulted a god. Several gods, probably, Sparhawk replied through clenched teeth. For a moment there, we all hovered on the brink of obliteration. Please, don't do that again, Amban. At least not without consulting me first.
He suddenly laughed, a bit sheepishly.
Now I know exactly how Sephrenia felt on any number of occasions. I'll have to apologize to her the next time I see her.
Amban was grinning with delight. I sort of caught them off balance there, didn't I?
Don't do it again, Your Grace, Sparhawk pleaded. I've seen what gods can do to people, and I don't want to be around if you really insult them.
Our god protects me.
Anias was praying to our god when Azash wrung him out like a wet rag, Your Grace. It didn't do him all that much good, as I recall.
That was really stupid, you know, Amban said then.
I'm glad you realize that.
Not me, Sparhawk. I'm talking about our adversary. Why did it reveal itself at this particular moment? It should have kept its flamboyant demonstration to itself and just listened. It could have found out what our plans are. Not only that, it revealed itself to Monsel. Until it appeared, he only had our word for the fact of its existence. Now he's seen it for himself. Will someone please explain this?
Monsel burst out.
It was the troll gods, Your Grace, Sparhawk told him.
That's absurd. There's no such thing as a troll, so how can they have gods?
This may take longer than I'd thought, Sparhawk muttered, half to himself. As a matter of fact, Your Grace, there are trolls.
Have you ever seen one? Monsel challenged.
Only one, Your Grace. His name was Gwerig. He was dwarfed, so he was only about 7 feet tall. He was still very difficult to kill.
You killed him?
Monsel gasped.
He had something I wanted.
Sparhawk shrugged.
Ulaf's seen a lot more of them than I have, Your Grace. He can tell you all about them.
He even speaks their language. I did for a while myself, but I've probably forgotten by now. Anyway, they have a language, which means that they're semi-human, and that means that they have gods, doesn't it?
Monsel looked helplessly at Emban. Don't ask me, my friend, the fat patriarch said. That's a long way out of my theological depth.
For the time being, you'll have to take my word for it, Sparhawk told them. There are trolls, and they do have gods. 5 of them. And these gods aren't very nice. That shadow Patriarch Emban just so casually dismissed was them, or something very much like them. And that's what we're up against. That's what's trying to bring down the Empire and the Church. Both our churches, probably. I'm sorry I have to put it to you so abruptly, our Commandrite Monsel, but you have to know what you're dealing with. Otherwise, you'll be totally defenseless. You don't have to believe what I just told you, but you'd better behave as if you did, because if you don't, your church doesn't have a chance of surviving.
The Aetons arrived a few days later. A hush fell over the city of Darsus as the citizens scurried for cover. No man is so entirely guiltless in his own soul that the sudden appearance of a few thousand police does not give him a qualm or two. The Aetons were superbly conditioned giants. The 2,000 warriors of both sexes ran in perfect unison as they entered the city 4 abreast. They wore short leather kirtles, burnished steel breastplates, and black half-boots. Their bare limbs gleamed golden in the morning sun as they ran, and their faces were stern and unbending. Though they were obviously soldiers, there was no uniformity in their weapons. They carried a random collection of swords, short spears, and axes, as well as other implements for which Sparhawk had no names. They all had several sheathed daggers strapped tightly to their arms and legs. They wore no helmets, but had slender gold circlets about their heads instead.
Lord, Kalton breathed to Sparhawk as the two of them stood on the palace battlements to watch the arrival of their escort. I'd really hate to come up against that lot on a battlefield. Just looking at them makes my blood cold.
I believe that's the idea, Kalton, Sparhawk said. Mirtai's impressive all by herself, but when you see a couple thousand of them like this, you begin to understand how the Tamils were able to conquer a continent without any particular difficulty. I'd imagine that whole armies simply capitulated when they saw them coming.
The Aetons entered the square in front of the palace and formed up before the residence of the Tamil ambassador. A huge man went to Ambassador Fontan's door, his pace quite clearly indicating that if the door were not open for him, he would walk right through it.
"Why don't we go down?" Sparhawk suggested. "I expect that Fontan will be bringing that fellow to call in a few moments. Watch what you say, Kalton. Those people strike me as a singularly humorless group. I'm sure they'd miss the point of almost any joke."
"Really?" Kalton breathed his agreement. The party accompanying the Queen of Alenia gathered in Her Majesty's private quarters and stood about rather nervously awaiting the arrival of the Tamil ambassador and his general. Sparhawk watched Mirtai rather closely to see what her reaction might be upon being reunited with her people after so many years. She wore clothing he had not seen her wear before, clothing that closely resembled that worn by her countrymen. In place of the steel breastplate, however, she wore a tight-fitting, sleeveless black leather jerkin, and the band about her brow was of silver rather than gold. Her face was serene, seeming to show neither anticipation nor nervous apprehension. She merely waited. Then Fontan and Oscania arrived with the tallest man Sparhawk had ever seen. They introduced him as Aetan Engessa. The word Aetan appeared to be not only the name of the people, but some kind of title as well. Engessa was well over 7 feet tall, and the room seemed to shrink as he entered. His age, probably because of his race, was indeterminate. He was lean and muscular, and his expression sternly unyielding. His face showed no evidence that he had ever smiled. Immediately upon his entrance into the room, he went directly to Mirtai, as if none of the rest of them were even in the room. He touched the fingertips of both hands to his steel-armored chest and inclined his head to her.
"Aetana Mirtai," he greeted her respectfully. Matan and Gessa, she replied, duplicating his gesture of greeting. Then they spoke to each other at some length in the Tamil tongue.
What are they saying?
Ilana asked Oscania, who had crossed to where they all stood. It's a ritual of greeting, Your Majesty, Oscania replied. There are a great many formalities involved when Etons meet. The rituals help to hold down the bloodshed, I believe. At the moment, Engessa's questioning Mirtai concerning her status as a child. The silver headband, you understand. It's an indication that she hasn't yet gone through the rite of passage. He stopped and listened for a moment as Mirtai spoke. She's explaining that she's been separated from humans since childhood, and hasn't had the opportunity to participate in the ritual as yet. Separated from humans? Ilana objected. What does she think we are? Etons believe that they are the only humans in the world. I'm not sure exactly what they consider us to be. The ambassador blinked. Has she really killed that many people? He asked with some surprise.
10?
Sparhawk asked. She said 34.
That's impossible, Ilana exclaimed. She's been a member of my court for the past 7 years. I'd have known if she'd killed anyone while she was in my service.
Not if she did it at night, you wouldn't, my queen, Sparhawk disagreed. She locks us in our rooms every night. She says that it's for our own protection. But maybe it's really so that she can go out looking for entertainment. Maybe we should change the procedure when we get home. Let's start locking her up for the night instead of the other way around.
She'll just kick the door down, Sparhawk.
That's true, I suppose. We could always chain her to the wall at night, I guess.
Sparhawk!
Ilana exclaimed. We can talk about it later. Here come Fontan and General Engessa. Etan Engessa, Sparhawk, Oscania corrected. Engessa wouldn't even recognize the title of general. He's a warrior, an Etan. That's all the title he seems to need. If you call him general, you'll insult him, and that's not a good idea. Engessa had a deep, quiet voice, and he spoke the Alenic language haltingly and with an exotic accent. He carefully repeated each of their names when Fontan introduced them, obviously committing them to memory. He accepted Ilana's status without question, although the concept of a queen must have been alien to him. He recognized Sparhawk and the other knights as warriors, and seemed to respect them as such. The status of Patriarch Emban, Talon, Dragon, and Baroness Melodir obviously baffled him. He greeted Kring, however, with the customary Paloi salute.
Etan Amirtai advises me that you seek marriage with her, he said.
That's right, Kring replied a bit pugnaciously. Have you any objections?
That depends. How many have you killed?
More than I can conveniently count.
That could mean two things. Either you have slain many, or you have a poor head for figures.
I can count past 200, Kring declared.
A respectable number. You are Domi among your people?
I am.
Who cut your head?
Engessa pointed at the scars on Kring's scalp and face. A friend. We were discussing each other's qualifications for leadership.
Why did you let him cut you?
I was busy. I had my saber in his belly at the time, and I was probing around for various things inside him.
Your scars are honorable, then. I respect them. Was he a good friend?
Kring nodded. The best. We were like brothers.
You spared him the inconvenience of growing old.
I did that, all right. He never got a day older.
I take no exception to your suit of Etan Amirtai, Engessa told him. She is a child with no family. As the first adult Etan she has met, it is my responsibility to serve as her father. Have you an Oma?
Sparhawk serves as my Oma.
Send him to me, and he and I will discuss the matter. May I call you friend, Domi?
I would be honored, Etan. May I also call you friend?
I also would be honored, friend Kring. Hopefully your Oma and I
will be able to arrange the day when you and Etana Mirtai will be branded.
May God speed the day, friend Engessa.
I feel as if I've just witnessed something from the Dark Ages,
Kalton whispered to Sparhawk.
What do you think would have happened if they'd taken a dislike to each other?
It probably would have been messy.
When do you want to leave, Aelana, Queen of Alenia? Engessa asked.
Aelana looked at her friends questioningly.
Tomorrow?
She suggested.
You should not ask, Aelana Queen,
Engessa reprimanded her firmly.
Command. If any object, have Sparhawk Champion kill them.
We've been trying to cut back on that, Etan Engessa, she said. It's always so hard on the carpeting.
Ah, he said. I knew there was a reason. Tomorrow, then?
Tomorrow, Engessa.
I will await you at first light, Aelana Queen.
And he turned on his heel and marched from the room.
Abrupt sort of fellow, isn't he?
Stragan noted.
He doesn't waste any words, Tinian agreed.
A word with you, Sparhawk, Kring said.
Of course.
You will serve as my Oma, won't you?
Of course.
Don't pledge too many horses, Kring frowned. What did he mean when he was talking about branding?
Sparhawk suddenly remembered.
It's an Etan wedding custom. During the ceremony, the happy couple is branded. Each wears the mark of the other.
Branded?
So I understand.
What if a couple doesn't get along?
I imagine they cross out the brand.
How do you cross out a brand?
Probably with a hot iron.
Are you still bent on marriage, Kring?
Find out where the brand goes, Sparhawk. I'll know better once I have that information.
I gather there are places where you'd rather not be branded?
Oh, yes. There are definitely places, Sparhawk.
They left Darsus at first light the following morning and rode eastward toward Pella on the steps of Central Astel. The Etons enclosed the column, loping easily to match the speed of the horses. Sparhawk's concerns about the safety of his queen diminished noticeably. Mirtai had very briefly, even peremptorily, advised her owner that she would travel with her countrymen. She did not precisely ask. A rather peculiar change had come over the golden giantess. That wary tension that had always characterized her seemed to have vanished.
I can't exactly put my finger on it, Aelana confessed about mid-morning when they were discussing it. She just doesn't seem quite the same.
She isn't, Your Majesty, Stragan told her. She's come home, that's all. Not only that, the presence of adults allows her to take her natural place in her own society. She's still a child, in her own eyes at least. She's never talked about her childhood, but I gather it wasn't a time filled with happiness and security. Something happened to her parents, and she was sold into slavery.
All of her people are slaves, Milord Stragan, Melodir objected.
There are different kinds of slavery, Baroness. The slavery of the Etan race by the Tamils is institutionalized. Mirtai's is personal. She was taken as a child, enslaved, and then forced to take her own steps to protect herself. Now that she's back among the Etans, she's able to recapture some sense of her childhood.
He made a wry face.
I never had that opportunity, of course. I was born into a different kind of slavery, and killing my father didn't really liberate me.
You concern yourself overmuch about that, Milord Stragan,
Melodir told him.
You really shouldn't make the issue of your unauthorized conception the central fact of your whole existence, you know. There are much more important things in life.
Stragan looked at her sharply, then laughed, his expression a bit sheepish.
Do I really seem so self-pitying to you, Baroness?
No, not really. But you always insist on bringing it up. Don't worry at it so much, my lord. It doesn't make any difference to the rest of us. So why brood about it?
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.